Sure
All
is
right,
live.
we are live. Welcome to the Refinery, episode 21. This is the three grassroots organizations come together to talk conservative messaging. And this is on Wednesday, November 5th, the day after the election. And it is a celebration. Does anybody have the music queued up? Probably not, huh? We're all thinking, cool in the game.
I mean, it's a soft one, but sorry. All right, that's all we can play. Now it gets into copyright infringement, and then we have to take the video down. So
I'll just give the factual rundown of the election, and I know at the end of last
week...
We're
all thinking it. I mean, you may as well say it.
We kicked some ass, man. We kicked some ass.
Yeah.
The Republicans, by we I mean Republicans, which usually I don't include the Republicans in we, but for today, we are all Republicans, because it's kind of a cool thing to be today. Check me tomorrow and that may change. But anyway, last week we made predictions and there was a range from, oh my God, I think we'll barely have a majority to, no, Joe Biden's going to be our boss to, it's going to be 52 or 53. Well, actually, we overachieved even the most optimistic of projections in the Senate, and because we've got 54 guaranteed seats, because we won Alaska, we're going to win Louisiana, but we might even win Virginia, which is probably not, but isn't it amazing that that's a possibility? We were projected to lose a couple of governor houses. We gained three. I don't know that anybody had really made any projections about the state houses, but we now have more state houses than I think at any time in the history of ever. And let's see, what other amazing, absolutely unbelievable things happened? There are like 20-something states that are, no, maybe it's just 14, states that are Republican governor, and both houses in the state are Republican, and it's just a complete Republican sweep at the state level. And guys, that means that we're going to be able to accomplish stuff, because we won't be able to accomplish anything in Washington for the next couple of years, but we can accomplish stuff at the states. With Republicans in charge, we can actually get some things done. It's really, really amazing. I'm pretty excited. And now we'll go, I think... For the first time, we're just going to go down the line and let everybody celebrate, and we'll go from left to right. So, Corey and Andy, celebrate!
Yay! Corey Gardner! We took a Senate seat, and let me tell you, in 2 years, we're going to take another.
And we got it from Mark Uterus. Take that, jerk.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was cleansing.
Yes.
I feel clean. This house is clean.
And then when you're done, just pass it to the next guy in the row.
Okay, next.
Next.
Hold on. Here we go. Wait a second.
The red print.
Yeah! Woo! Cool.
We're totally turning it back into the red print. This is just the beginning, and actually, we'll talk about this more later, but we've been hearing from a lot of grassroots people that they see this as a start, not as... a time to sit back and enjoy, but a time to get ready and get started on changing the state back red.
Long story short, we're gearing 2015 around uniting the right in Colorado.
Outstanding.
Including the bigwigs. Next.
I don't know who's in what order, so.
Dan, you're up.
Am I? Oh, I saw you next to them. I'm sorry.
Yeah, just look at the film strip down on the bottom. Go left to right.
I think we're all on the right for ourselves, though, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm seeing to the left with her, and then next is Delbert. But I'll go. All right.
Yeah, go, Dan.
I am so excited. And you know what? I'm Texan, but I grew up in Alaska, so I am really excited about the fact that we took it there, too. It just, you know, and the fact that they spent so much money to turn Texas blue, and they screwed it up. They just dropped it. It did not work for them, and I'm so happy about that. Anyway. There I am. Next.
Delbert, hit it up.
I'll take it. I'm Oregonian, and it's a little bit disappointing in my state, so tonight I'm Texan. I'm thrilled at the results of last night and haven't been so hopeful in a long time.
All right, I'm going to go because you know what? I'm from a blue state. I didn't have a particularly good night last night as far as local politics was concerned. Jeff Bell did not surprise the world and come through with a win over Cory Booker. But we have a Republican governor up in Massachusetts. We've got a Republican governor in Maryland, and we've got a Republican governor in Illinois. So that's a pretty big deal, in addition to the fact that somebody, I'm not going to name names, but somebody was the optimist last week on the refinery at the end of the day and said such things as the Republicans were going to surprise everybody to the upside and we're going to not have a runoff in Georgia. I'm not going to name names who that was, but it was a good day for that person. Now somebody else go.
Fine, I'm from Texas, I'll go. All I really have to say is, Wendy Davis, your 5 minutes are up. And in honor of a very, very red Texas, I have a bottle of Glenlivet 15. So,
hot dog.
To the Republican victory in 2014, the tsunami. Thank you.
Like the Red Wedding.
That's the second time I've heard that, the Red Wedding, in reference to this election.
I can't help it, though, man. I mean, it's so true.
Blood everywhere, yes.
Better red than dead.
Ryan and Fishy, you guys are the still have yet to celebrate.
Fishy, go.
Okay, well, I was just saying, I'm really enjoying it from the state of Texas as well. It's nice to see the president get literally get his asses handed to him.
Very nice. Very, very nice.
Is that a donkey reference? Just asking.
Yeah, I think so.
So when are you guys kicking Wendy out? Is she like, you know, I'm sure she's making her trek over here to the East Coast.
I think she's going to be starting on MSNBC tomorrow or something.
Yeah, right now.
She's welcome to stay. I just don't think that she can deal with the fact that every Republican in the state wants to drink her tears.
Let me tell you, real quick, the greatest thing about that race, not just that she was so handily defeated by Greg Abbott, who rolled over her, is that she ended up giving up her Senate seat in Texas, which is a Republican pickup because Connie freaking Burton took it. Yes. So Wendy gave up the seat and turned it red.
So wait a second. What happened to Wendy Davis? What happened to her?
Greg Abbott in the state rolled senator
over her. Yeah.
He did what?
Rolled over her.
I hope he was using his extra tread wheelchair wheels with the spikes on it.
Oh, that's so dark.
He went total punk on her.
Yeah.
And even though Delbert didn't say it, there actually was a little bit of good news from Oregon in the midst of all of the blueness of that state. The one thing in Oregon that got more votes than any other thing was the vote against giving driver's licenses to illegals. Yeah. That's an issue that we Republicans need to stay really firm on, is legality issues, because it seems that legality and rule of law seem to be the kind of issue that reaches beyond just the Republican Party and reaches out to moderates and people of goodwill. So, you know, that even in Oregon, when they're going to vote for a governor whose wife is a criminal in very many ways. They voted for that, and they voted for what, increased minimum wage and all sorts of stupid things because it's Oregon. But they also voted to keep driver's license out of the hands of illegals because they're not completely stupid. So that was really some good news.
And thank you for correcting that. I was just cringing when you said Oregon. It's Oregon, as in I'm going to get a gun.
Yeah, it's Oregon. I was saying.
And Delbert, I just want you to know, as a Texan, I completely sympathize with you. I spent a better part of 12, maybe 15 years there. And I don't say I graduated high school. I say I was paroled and quickly left the state. So I feel your pain, and that's why I left 25-some-odd years ago. So
I remain here to be a thorn in their side.
You're a stronger man than me.
Ryan, we have not heard from Ryan yet. Ryan, get in on this. Exult.
I'm from Utah, so it's not like there was any close races out here or anything. The outcome wasn't really ever in doubt.
Mia, come on.
That was my next point. Whoever Mia Love got elected. We have a, you know, from Utah, everyone thinks is all white. We have a black woman representative in Congress now. She's the first African-American female from the GOP, I believe. So that's pretty cool. Other than that, I'm more here tonight to learn what we can do going forward to make this actually count, make it matter.
Hey, guys, can I chime in on one? I forgot something. Corey and I, our home state is Wisconsin. Yeah, baby.
Go Wisconsin, yeah.
He turned him back again. Just a yet another whipping, another beatdown for the unions. Do you guys realize how many millions of dollars pour into Wisconsin constantly? Nobody in Wisconsin anymore holds any other job except campaign canvassing.
Can I point out one thing about Wisconsin is that the governor there has won as many times in 4 years as Crist has lost in Florida.
Yeah, baby! Outside of Wendy Davis, wasn't that the one that probably made us the nasty part of us the happiest?
Yeah, that was sweet. It wasn't so much that I wanted Rick Scott to win, but I really, really wanted Charlie Crist to lose.
Actually, the one that made me the happiest kind of goes with the whole Wendy Davis thing, and that is the fluke that failed in California. 2-1 loss.
2-1?
2-1.
Oh,
can I just say
this?
I'm sorry, Sandra.
My uterus.
China was revoked 2-1 by some birth control.
Oh, hey.
Tampons have just been banned. I've got and right now. Special. It was just like a unanimous vote from the Republicans in the Senate. It is a part of the new barefoot mandate. troubling news. Bad times.
Trying to rub in with the grassroots sect there.
Hey guys. Let me throw one in here. I am so happy about the blowout in Kansas. Amazing. Greg Orman, the liar who said he was an independent. And, I mean, my gosh, that liar, absolute liar. He was polling 3 to 5 points ahead for a month. And he got beat by 11. He got smoked. Unbelievable. I mean, I've heard of a wave election turning things. Guys, I haven't heard of this. Unbelievable. And that was just wonderful because there you got to see a complete and absolute liar go down in flames. It was wonderful.
And I
those
think
tactics. Sorry, go ahead.
No, with him and Angus King, the independent in Maine, I think what we've seen today is the truth of the lie of an independent candidate. Both of those independent candidates have said that they would caucus with the majority. Now, we absolutely knew that Greg Orman would not caucus with the Republicans. He was going to caucus with the Democrats. Even Joe Biden admitted it. But what we saw was Angus King had always maintained that he would caucus with the majority. And when he was asked today, he said, no, I'm gonna stick with the Democrats because he's not an independent. He's a Democrat. Yeah, Angus King is going to continue to caucus with the Democrats, unlike the promises that he made. And we just need to realize and grow up as an electorate and understand that when they say they're independents, it's because they're afraid to say they're Democrats. And when they say they're independents or moderates, it's because they're afraid to say that they are liberal progressive Democrats. Because you cannot win a race as a liberal progressive Democrat. You have to pretend to be conservative, and then when you're elected, you really become a Democrat. And I think we've put the lie to a lot of that stuff in the last couple of days. It's been kind of neat.
Yeah.
I have to admit I'm really depressed about that because Angus King has the best name in the Senate now that we no longer have Saxby Chambliss. So we are losing in the awesome name department now in the Senate. We'll have to resolve that sometime in 2016.
Hmm.
Wait. Don't we still have Thad Cochran?
Thad Cochran is still there, but he's a close second at best.
Oh, who's the first then?
Angus King. Angus King has the best name in the Senate.
If we work on that, saying Thad, it might sound better. It might put it to the top.
Thad. Yeah. See? Okay.
Hmm? Yeah, he is from Mississippi. You got to say it is two syllables. Thad.
Well, if you got to have the drawl too. Thad Cochran.
By the way, thank you to Thad Cochran for, even though he caused a lot of, messed up stuff this year, he actually was able to win his race. We have him. He's going to be a part of the Republican Party. We get to have another vote. We did not cede that seat to the Democrats. So in spite of all of the stuff that happened this year with McDaniel and all that, thanks that we have Thad still in his seat. We still have, that Republican seat is there, regardless of all of that mess that happened down there. So, I'm glad about that.
Do you know, I see almost as many faces on this screen as the Democrats have governorships. I mean, right now.
17 now? 17?
Look, they could barely, I mean, you could put them all together and right now they could govern Puerto Rico. I mean, this is incredible. There aren't any of them left. They're all gone. It's wonderful, except in our state. But,
yeah. Oh, well. Yeah, really.
What happened in your state? I did not hear the final tally on that governorship.
Oh, he won easily. The Democrat did. But
Macklemore, whatever his name was.
Hickenlooper. That's a good name.
Hickenlooper.
Hickenlooper is a powerful candidate. And I have been saying now for the last couple of years that the Democrats should strongly consider him for presidency instead of Hillary. He would be a stronger candidate. Trust me. So the fact that we came that close is really it's because of a red wave. We actually would have beaten him if it hadn't been for there was still a fair amount of division here and people voting third party and staying home. Due to, the usual divisions in the conservative coalition. So, but he is a powerful, powerful candidate.
But he's also an old white guy, so hopefully we can diversify and beat them there if he happens to be the next candidate for the Dems in 2016. But I don't think that he will be able to beat the Clinton machine in that primary, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. We're still celebrating because I talked about it before, but Michelle Nunn,
loser,
wonderful.
We could have, she could have made it difficult. She could have made it tough, but no. Purdue said not going to happen. Getting over 50% of the vote. No runoff.
Yeah. And yeah, we've got a runoff in Louisiana, but if that one's gonna go our way, right?
Well, considering that Manus had what
11%
of the vote, so yeah, there that's more than enough of those Manus voters will be hopping over and get that thing finished up in December.
Yeah, since Cassidy got more votes than Landrieu anyway, even though he didn't break 50, he beat Landrieu. So there's no way that, I mean, Landrieu would have to take all of Maness's votes, and I think she'd have to pull some of Cassidy's, and that's just not going to happen, I don't think.
On a straight up vote, Landrieu pulled 42-41. She just barely edged, what's his name? But if you combine the Republicans, she got trounced.
Yeah.
Body slam.
So I wanted to ask a quick question. When you're at work, it's like I'm trying to juggle work and read all of those articles with liberals just crying all over themselves. I'm like, bookmark, 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 come back later. And something caught my eye that the polling was way, way off. It was skewed like 5 or 6 points for Democrats across the board. And that's why the Democrats were upset across the board, because everything was skewed. Has anybody seen more on that or can confirm it? I'm just curious.
Well, they were talking about it on Fox News this morning, and they just said, and they had a couple of their experts on, and they just said, look, it's a simple matter of they took the polls as they were, but they were breaking hard, right, and they waited. And they said the thing that was really odd is that the polls waited so long, to, like the last day or two, to break hard, right. And that's unusual. So that's what they said. And they said, but they broke so hard, right, that it was shocking. By the way, I hear that Hillary, if she runs in 2016, which she will, she has requested that she not be sent to campaign for her in any states after her performance yesterday.
Because, yeah, I think Jean Shaheen was the only person that Hillary actually helped to victory.
Yeah, real tough.
Yeah, and that was because, you know, Jean Shaheen beat a carpetbagger.
Not only a carpetbagger that decided to join the election like 2 seconds away from it being over. So, you know, this was an ad hoc campaign at best from Scott Brown, and he still almost beat. I mean, that's still kind of contestable. I mean, you know, you should be able to. I mean, it's close. It's a close race still. I mean, if they wanted to challenge it. I don't think that there would be too much of a problem finding that. If it was a Democrat, they would be able to find those votes. I'll say that.
Well, exactly. He'd be able to. Yes, exactly. And getting back to Hillary and the whole Clinton machine of being able to campaign for people and really help push them over the top in elections, and the super powerful mystique that the Clintons have as far as all of the fundraising, and they're just the powerhouse dynamo of the Democrat Party, and how awesome it is now that they run the Democrat Party and they've taken over from Obama, and we should really all be scared. Arkansas is now 100% Republican from top to bottom, and that's in spite of it being the Clintons' home state and them campaigning very hard for people in their own home state. They lost their home state really big. So,
you know, I just want to point out, you can only molest so many women before a state swings the opposite way. I'm just going to say. And if you campaign in a blue dress, that is not going to go well for you. I'm not making that in jest. The gal that was campaigning, or somebody was campaigning for, or Bill showed up at a campaign for somebody, and the gal had on a blue dress. I'm like, could you be any more tacky?
Yeah, really? Oh, my God.
Oh, Lord.
Is this the Democrat war on women that we're seeing? Is that what's going on?
Apparently. Yeah, can we put that whole war on women thing to bed? I mean, have we won the war finally? Is it over?
To bed?
Yeah, sorry.
Again, because in Oregon, they voted for equal rights for women, and it passed.
You know, I was just smoking a cigar when I mentioned Clinton, but anyway. stuff writes itself. Come on.
Oh, my God.
The entire first 30 minutes of this show is unclippable. There's not a single clip to be found here.
Because so there's nothing rational that we're saying.
All right. Well, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm pretty content with my gloating and Schadenfreude and all of that fun stuff. I'm good. I'm ready to get down to brass tacks and focus on what's going on going forward with the results from this election. How about everybody else?
Wait, one last thing. I got to ask one last question. I need to hear from you guys. What was the dumbest, most insanely idiotic comment leading up to yesterday? I've got two finalists. Maybe you guys can add one. Certainly Michelle Obama's fried chicken comment.
Oh, my God.
That was beyond description. And then Mary Landrieu explaining her struggles because of all the bigotry among Southern voters.
Louisiana is so racist and sexist. That's why.
I'm sorry, but, you know, why didn't she just say, and, you know, they really sleep a lot with their families. I mean, let's go the whole way.
No, that's Arkansas.
They're all drug pushers, and, you know, the whole South is just evil. Well, Landrieu.
You know, she doesn't live here. How does she know what we're like? You know, and you listen to something like that, and you're like, and you want me to vote for you?
I have an honorable mention, but it won't qualify as a win.
What?
I have an honorable mention. I didn't watch hardly any coverage last night, but I watched a little bit of Fox News just to try to see what the results were going to be. And Juan Williams had the audacity to look right in the camera and say, no, this isn't really a wave. I don't know what would constitute a wave, but this is not a Republican wave.
I don't know what porn is, but I'll know it when I see it.
See, there you go. So there's my honorable mention.
I definitely, my vote is to Mary Landrieu's comment about the racist South, who, by the way, elected their first Black senator since Reconstruction, and oh, by the way, he was Republican, Tim Scott.
Yep.
So, tears, delicious tears. Delicious, progressive tears.
I got to go with Michelle Obama, because, quite frankly, go vote Democrat and then eat fried chicken. Could you be any more racist?
Well, look at the bright side about that. If we ever make comments about fried chicken from here on out, we no longer be called racist.
I don't think that's how it works. No. I don't think that's how any of this works.
I was hoping. I hope.
No.
See, the thing is, I actually love fried chicken, so and I'm white. I'm not quite sure where to go with it.
I'm pretty sure you're allowed.
Confused. What?
You're either allowed.
If anyone on this call doesn't love fried chicken, please hang up now. Go away. You're not permitted.
Church's chicken. It's a show that caters to Black Americans. I mean, she wasn't just talking to Democrats. Talking specifically
to Black people. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was horrible.
He's like, if you go vote, we're going to let you have some chicken. What, lady? Lady, you did not.
Yeah. And some fried okra.
Well, in Texas, we had an interesting breakdown. I'm just going to go all fact on you based on what I found in an image that was shared on, interestingly, Sensible Politics, who used it to say how stupid Texans are. But the breakdown between the Abbott voters and the Davis voters went like this. White men were 33% of the vote. They broke 80% for Abbott. White women, 33% of the vote. They broke 2-1, 67% for Abbott. Black men, they were 5% of the vote, and they broke 90% for Davis. Black women, 7% of the vote, they broke 94% for Davis. Latino men made 8% of the electorate, 50% for Abbott.
Wow.
And Latino women, 61% for Davis, and that was 9% of the electorate. So it was very interesting. the women divide in Texas over that very war on women-y kind of campaign broke along racial lines.
Yeah.
What was more interesting, though, is if you just look at women as a whole, you say, okay, here's all the women in Texas. Ignore race. 2-1 they voted for Abbott. 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Wendy Davis. Yeah, go on The Daily Show and tell everybody how you're going to be governor of Texas.
Yeah. All right, well, strategy-wise going forward, what do we got?
Well, I think we need to look at, too, the kind of ground that we're on and see what for what it is and for what it isn't. I think most of us could agree this is definitely not a referendum on approval of Republicans.
Exactly.
It is more a repudiation of the president and his policies and his representatives and his surrogates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this goes back to the fact that Obama's the perpetual campaigner, that he doesn't know how to govern. He has not put forth anything to govern. He's not done anything in terms of positive action that has a broad mandate. It's all very narrow, 51%, I got this, so I get to choose legislation, very divisive stuff. And if he were the sort who was trying to govern instead of campaign, this ground would be very different. So we were sort of, I guess, gifted with the fact that what had been our perpetual problem before with Obama, president, campaigner in chief, now this cycle worked against him, and he's not on the ballot again. So going forward, we're looking at an electorate who is into personality politics, but doesn't show up when the rock star isn't there, even if the rock star's quote-unquote policies are.
Something that I'd like to make a note of is that voting matters. You know, from all that I saw with Project Veritas and the problems with voting machines and the using illegal aliens to potentially vote or non-residents to vote, we still came out on top.
Yeah. Well, also the fact that the cult of personality that had started 6 years ago with him are now out of college and still looking for work or a decent job instead of a part-time job. And I think the reality has hit a lot of them in the face. And they may not have, and generally they have been raised in a liberal household, and so they may not really like Republicans as a general rule. They got to think anything's better than what's currently out there right now, and they're realizing that. And so, like Swen said before many times, that the chance has been given to the Republicans just to prove themselves. And I think that's important.
And another thing that I saw today, I'm going to try to find that article. JD's got some images from it about the amount of money spent on campaigns. This was a very expensive set of races that we dealt with. He's got some graphics he's going to put up. The first one, I think, is just all money spent, Democrats and Republicans, on 7 crucial races.
Yeah, I just need to be speaking while I put that up because that's how Google Plus works with this, and it's being difficult for me. So give me 1 second on that. Sorry, I said that it was done, but it's apparently not working the way that I want it to.
Sure. Well, no, this is an article in Town Hall. It's the tip sheet, and it is from Kevin Glass. The losers of 2014 are people who want to buy elections.
Okay, there we go. There's that's the first. This is the first graph there. So I don't know, Leslie, if you can click on me using the Conservative Union thing, that should keep my image up.
I did.
And Fisher will be able to. Okay, so Fisher, you can talk now.
So what you're looking at is these 7 key races. Arkansas and Alaska and Colorado and Iowa and Kentucky and Louisiana and North Carolina, in which you could see how much money was spent by each side. You could see that North Carolina, the Democrats poured a bunch into that race, and she didn't win. In Kentucky, the Republicans poured a bunch into that race, and they did. So you can't really make those distinct. It's the only race, by the way, in this graph in which Republicans spent more was Kentucky, was Allison Grimes, was McConnell. So that was fascinating. But every one of these other ones, you can see the Democrats poured dollars in, and there was not that return for it. So we have another graphic. I'll let JD get that one set up. All right. So this one compares the differences between the different types of money. So it's the same races. No, it's not. It's most the same races, but Michigan's been included here. And you can see which groups have put which money. And, of course, the darker colors are the money that's not disclosed through the campaign itself or through a party itself. It's, you know, other spending. You can see how much money is being poured in to these different races. And, again, you can see Kentucky, a whole bunch of Republican spending, North Carolina, a whole bunch of Democrat spending, and the results didn't track based on who spent the most money or how much of it or what type of money.
Did they I noticed Kansas isn't on there. What did anybody get a result for that? I know that it's one we held, not one we took, but I'm just curious where the spending was on that.
Yeah, no, this article didn't address that. It took those races that were deemed to be closest, the toss-ups, the one everybody was ones everybody was watching, and threw that in there. So I couldn't get an answer for you for that.
But yeah, that's fine. I just was curious. Thanks.
And that brings up a point question. Just as a point of reference, I had seen a – let me deselect JD. So that it goes back to whatever. I had seen a thing on Open Secrets about the total spending on the different races through the years, and their estimate for 2014 was $4 billion spent on this election, which is about the same as what was spent in the last midterm. And so it's kind of on track as far as the amount of money spent. And you think $4 billion spent on one little election, that's just a ton of money. We've got to get all this money out of politics. Oh, my gosh, that's horrible. But then you step back and think, well, that's the amount of money spent to determine the political structure of this entire huge nation for the next 2 years, so maybe it's not too bad. How does that compare to some of the other spending that goes on in this nation? Because really, that $4 billion does set what goes on politically in this whole country. And then you go, okay, so $4 billion, how does that relate to, well, I don't know, Halloween?
Quick question. Here's a quick question. What's the total budget for the United States for 1 year?
I don't know, but on Halloween we spend $7.5 billion.
Okay,
as a country, we spend $7.5 billion on Halloween. So $4 billion is not really that much.
And I think the answer to that question, real quick, Brass, is something like 3-point-something trillion.
Trillion? I thought it was 1.4 trillion. I mean, I could be wrong. I just was curious.
Is that federal government outlays or whatever?
Yeah, I'm just curious what the federal government outlay. No, actually, I think we brought in $3 trillion, so it has to be more. So I think you're right, because we're deficit spending. So.
Yeah.
Well, now, wait a minute. I had heard that John McCain had pushed legislation to get the big money out of Halloween.
Well, you know, the candy corn lobby really was able to overcome his objections.
Ryan's got a really good point. I want him to jump in here and make it.
Well, the question was asked, how much is the national budget per year? And unless I'm missing something, I think the answer to that is zero. The Harry Reid's Democrats never passed a budget.
Very true.
Well, in that case, the campaign spending is way over budget.
Uh, I mean, it's obvious that there's a lot of campaign spending, but and it's obvious when you look at Open Secrets, the last three elections, 2014, 2012, and 2010, there was a major jump. And that was in large part because there's so much more federal government involvement in our lives that spending money on politics makes more sense than spending money on marketing your product, you know. So as a business person, I'm gonna choose to spend my money to buy a politician more so than to buy an ad or a billboard, because buying a politician is gonna do more for my company, and that's because we've got too much government in our lives, and that's why we have too much money. And too much money in politics is because politics is too much in our lives. So,
well, let me give you some perspective here. This is based on a budget, or I should say, outlays of $3.4 trillion by the federal government every year. Or that's what the spending is supposedly at, $3.4 trillion. Now, if it's more, that's fine. But based on $3.4 trillion spent per year, $4 billion is equal to 0.001% of that. So,
and that's for 2 years. That $4 billion covers 2 years' worth of political structure federally.
So, hold on. Let me just do seven.
Our colleagues, the House and the Senate have failed to pass a joint budget bill on multiple occasions since 1983.
0.005. Three zeros and a 5-7. I could round it up and make it six, but I mean 0.0006.
Percent.
Really.
And consider that spending goes to printing and to employing people to make calls or to do election activities. It isn't like that isn't helping the economy in some sector, and that if you removed that spending, that it would do more productive things. Those are productive things.
By the way, wouldn't those technically qualify as shovel-ready jobs?
Because it's all about BS, unusual BS, yeah.
Hey, guys, can I ask a question here? And I don't mean to jump into one of my articles too much, but talking about what we got to do, because I did write an article, What Should We Do If We Win? And without going through all of it, just it seems to me that the Democrats, there are two big reasons that people are sick of them. And somebody else tossed in another one, competency, and I think that's true, too. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly incompetent in their job. But the two big reasons, I would say, are control and protection. In other words, this government is bass-ackward under Obama in what it's supposed to do. It's controlling us, not the threats to us. Okay, so it does nothing about ISIS, nothing about the border, nothing about Ebola, nothing about anything that threatens our freedom, our liberty. And yet, it expends incredible resources to control us through Obamacare, through everything they can possibly, even targeting various groups through the IRS and so forth. I think that what the Republicans, for us to turn around and just go after them with some list and say, here's our list of things, we want to put all these things through, I don't think the American people are going to embrace that. I think they're going to see that as, now you're in charge, so you're going to try to make your list into law. I think the way we got to go after them is to say, no. They tried to control you. We want to unleash your choices, and we want to protect your choices from threats. They didn't protect you because they don't value you. We do. We want to protect you, and we want to unleash you. And then have that as a basic message and then put everything within that, you know, and then as you pick apart Obamacare and show, okay, now we're going to give you choices here, they took it away. And just, you know, your gun rights, we're going to let you decide for yourself how you defend yourself and so forth. You know, have a general vision rather than reeling out a bunch of one after the other issues. You know, I think would be a better way to go.
Ryan, I know you want to get in on this, so What do you mean you don't have anything to say? You want to talk about it? Come on.
No, I didn't mean I wanted to talk about it. I meant I wanted Andy to talk about it. I wanted to hear all of your ideas. Like, how I like the message of we need to get choice out there. We need to say, look, we're not going to just run our agenda and do our time. We want to give you freedom. But how do we get that message out there? Can the 8 or 9 of us do something together? Can we work in our communities and blogs to get that message out? How do we get that message to the politicians so that they actually do that and they say those things? Is there anything we can actually do to do that? I mean, that's more my question. I don't have any suggestions. I don't know what we can do, but I think it's a great message that should be out there.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I'm actually going to be contacting leadership here in Colorado, and I also, you know, I'm preaching it on the radio out here. But, yeah, you're right. It's frustrating because we come up with good things to do, and then we see those things not done. And we feel helpless. And I think the key right now is to not let ourselves feel helpless, to not give up. We are starting to have more impact, I believe, on our leaders than at least we were a couple few years ago. And we got to keep pushing.
Yeah. I mean, considering the avenues of communication that we have open to us now, the fact that we are just a tweet away from a lot of important people, and these are things that we can communicate, especially to local politicians. If you talk to your, I mean, we just went through the meet and greet season, the part of the year or the part of the political cycle where you get to meet your congressperson on a regular basis because they're trying to win your vote again, but. There are ways that you can communicate with them, and certainly by campaigning for them, that's a way that you build that that sort of connection to get your ideas out there and to them. And I can tell you right now, I know staffers for my congressperson. They know how many phone calls I made for them. They know how many phone calls or how many blocks I walked or the stuff that I did. So. That's a way that you can get a more direct line of communication to talk about these ideas. And I think that there's a good, I can send these articles to these people. That's about as direct as it gets.
You know, one of the things I mentioned, and I think because we talked about this at the beginning, it's so important to understand, no, we don't have a mandate, but we have an opportunity to create one. The American people have given us an opportunity to create a mandate. And, you know, in the article, I use the analogy of, you know, how many of us, especially us guys, have been at a party, high school or college party, and seen a girl. She breaks up with her boyfriend there at the party, and some nice guy gives her a ride home. The nice guy gives her the ride home. And it's important for the nice guy to understand you don't have a mandate. She just dumped the other guy. Okay, but you have a great opportunity. Be what the other guy isn't. Okay, he was controlling. He didn't care about her. Don't be controlling. Do care about her. Now look at the American voters. Look at the American public. The Democrats don't care about protecting them, and they do care about controlling them. Be the opposite. It's a simple message. It's the same as the Founding Fathers. We want to unleash your liberty, and we want to protect the setting in which you live that liberty. Okay? That's what we want to do. And I think if we go to our leadership and just say, look, I'm sure that you've got a lot of great ideas that you're going to advance. You just won. Good for you. Do it. But do it within a simple message, because if we just have a bunch of people all over the place advancing this, and everybody's got their pet project because we just won, and I've got mine, and Ryan has his, and Fishy has hers, we're going to sound like noise. One simple message. The other side has been trying to control you. We want to unleash you. The other side, and when you try to control people like cattle, you lose respect for them, and there's no reason to protect them. we are going to protect you. You know, no flights from Ebola countries. You know, if there's terrorist threats, we're not going to trade terrorists for deserters. Okay, little things like that. But everywhere you look, we are going to go after any threat to you. And does that kind of make sense?
No, it does make a lot of sense. I think that we need to be of a sound singular voice in so many ways, because like you said, it causes a lot of white noise and just blocks everything out and nothing gets done. But you have to look at who voted where, you know, what, because a lot of them are going to have been on the fence people or liberals even that voted for this because they saw the BS. That's what let's call it what it is. It was just the BS. I mean, we're Republicans or conservatives, libertarians, we like to use logic and not emotion, you know, to try to figure out what needs to be done, you know, and they kept using the emotional part of people to get them drawn in. And it's very hard when you have a group of people that are so used to that to wean them off of it and say, look, these are the facts. These, what matters to you? Tell us what matters to you. Not the emotional part of it, but it's what, to feed your family, to make sure you've got something for retirement, to make sure that and how it works. How does it work? Well, if you tax people too much, they can't create jobs. If they can't create jobs, you can't work. If you can't work, you have a hard time buying stuff, you know? Yeah, and this, I guess I'm going off on a tangent, but what I'm saying is that we really need to reach down to the very core of the thing with what made that libertarian or what made that liberal vote the way he did.
You're not going on a tangent at all. Look at what Rand Paul has been saying. We've got to look at the inner city.
Yeah.
As an example, and bring capitalism to them, bring choices to them. The other side wants to herd you as cattle and regard you that way. We want to unleash enterprise zones, you can call it the old Jack Kemp ideal, okay? Mm-hmm. We want to unleash you with choice and liberty, okay? And we'll help get you going because we believe in you.
Yep.
Believe
and how bad? I'm sorry, but how bad will it look when the Republicans have a jobs plan, something that's actually positive, something that you know they can go for and talk about, and it's a positive thing. It's not the party of no, it's the party of yes, here's something that we're getting done. And it goes to Obama's desk, and he says, no, veto that.
Well, okay, but just given those parameters without any additional information, you know what the spin is going to be. And so having that answer that Andy's talking about is crucial, because doing the thing is not as important in the next 2 years. Though it is important, it's not as important as in the next two years as what you are seen to be doing. And if you don't have the mechanism behind it to say, this is what we know will unleash you, this will allow businesses to grow and people to choose their own destiny and get unleashed the way that Andy's talking about, unless we're accompanying that action with the proper messaging and sales pitches, we will get the Republicans just want to hurt people and this is what they do. They give me this stuff, but I'm standing strong against whatever those crazy Republicans are throwing at us because I'm trying to protect you. That's the messaging that we're going to have to come against. And the way to do it is through what Andy's talking about. And I think that's a great example, especially with jobs, given what we're seeing in the inner cities.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, here's a better example. And I'm not going to give hard facts because I don't have any on the top of my head. But you've got a state. The tax rates are going up incredibly high. So a few very large businesses are moving out. So all of this before the election, people are losing their jobs because of the fact these companies are moving out. And they know why they're moving out. Taxes. Okay? So now they know this fact that they moved from state to now to Texas because we're awesome, like everyone else knows. And now the elections happen. And one of the messages that our representatives can say is, like, we want to cut taxes because that will create jobs. And then that's going to resonate with the people that just saw themselves lose a job when they were libertarian or liberals because that company moved out because it was taxes. You know, if they hadn't been taxed so high, they could have stayed. They could have kept their job. So these are the facts that we can lay out right in front of their face and say, exactly like you were saying, we want to protect you. We want to make you grow. We want to see you be successful. And by doing this, this, and this, this will happen. Because if you look at that, that, and that, you'll see how it goes in hand to hand. That makes sense?
I want to jump in here real quick, and we're talking really two different ways of approaching this. One is you have the high level message that you want to bring to the nation, which is, you know, hey, the Republicans stand for this. But I also want to point out very pointedly that we also have to talk to individuals personally. And I'm not suggesting that we're not going to do that. What I'm suggesting is that we have to engage people at an individual level. I have something I want to bring up later, because I have a friend that I consider to be very liberal who actually sent me an email today asking why a black person should vote Republican. And I was like, are you punking me or are you being serious? And to be honest, the more I've read it, the more I think she's actually serious. And I do want to talk about that later, but with regards to a person, I'll give you an example here in Texas of how I think we can hit people, specifically the Latino population, on a personal level. Take a look at the platform that the Democratic Party stands for, and then contrast it with their actual values, and you start to say, look, your values are this. The Democratic Party's values are the antithesis of what you actually believe. And so you can compare and contrast and say, is this where you want to go? Because if that's where you want to go, then that's actually the way that you want to vote. But I think when it comes down to it, you look at the Latino population, they're very heavily Roman Catholic. And so when you compare and contrast their beliefs with what the party platform is for the Democratic Party, they find that there's a huge disconnect, and so they start to question whether or not that's really the case. And when you start to talk about economic issues, part of the reason they vote Democrat is because they want to care for their family. So what you do is you say, look, the solutions that we have as a party, but also on a personal level, is that these are going to affect you on a personal level. It puts more money in your pocket. That's more money for you, more money for your family. And state it like that. Because when you do, it's hard for the Democratic Party, and yes, they'll spin it. They always do. It's something we have to deal with. But when you keep hammering home the message, we give you more than they do, we give you more rights, we give you more money, we give you more freedoms, you have more choices, it's hard for them to spin that, even though they'll do their damnedest to do so.
And if I can jump in for a sec, at the base of all this, by the way, I love what you're saying, at the base of all this is, we believe in you. You are incredible. You are magnificent. And I'm not saying that as hype. I believe that of all people. They are fantastic. They are miracles. You're not cattle. You're fantastic. You are to be unleashed. And I firmly believe that if we stop making it so expensive to hire you, so expensive to build, to create jobs here rather than shipping them everywhere else overseas, so expensive to invest in your next idea. No, you will unleash it because we believe in you. And by the way, we're going to be there with you.
I want to piggyback on that because this is something that's been on my mind for several months. I really want, and I don't really know how to reach out to the black community in terms of an outreach or anything, but one thing that I've always looked at is the black community as a whole seems to rely so much on welfare. And I wonder how many great ideas, how many great businesses, how many great inventions are lost because the black community isn't taught banking, they aren't taught business, they aren't taught business skills, they aren't taught how to take an idea that they have and bring it to market. How much of the American ideal has been sapped because the black community and any other democratic community has been put on welfare and said, well, if you just vote for us, we'll give you money. Well, what about all the great inventions and the great ideas? How much better could our world be, and that we've lost because of that?
Well, isn't the question, why haven't they taught these things to you? Why haven't they taught these things to you? Because they don't think things are for you. You don't teach those things to people who you just want to herd through life. You teach those things to people who you believe in and who you're excited about and who you want unleashed. I would say one thing to your friend. One thing that I always say, and this is going to come out of the blue, and I've mentioned this a couple times on this show. I think we've got to get real with the big, pardon the French, elephant in the room about why the black population has a very good reason for distrusting us. And by us, I don't mean Republicans, I mean white people. And that is this. 220 years of all white male presidents in a row, and then we come down on them for voting 95% for a black man. How can we say that 220 years that we were not quota voting and that we always chose the best person in the country? And so I would look at a person of color, be it your friend that you're talking about or something like this, and just say, hey, first of all, just so you know, I don't think you should be quick to trust us. I don't think you should be too quick to trust anyone. Because you know what? You guys waited, your community waited 220 years to have somebody who didn't look like me as your president.
I agree. And my response is, I don't think you should vote Republican, which I think will floor her.
I wouldn't go that far. But what I would say then is just say, now, that was quota voting. That was 220 years of we want this type as president. That wasn't picking the best person, but you know what? We just did 8 years of quota voting. I got a better idea. How about when you and I talk, I know you. What's her name, by the way?
Her name is Regent. She's not technically my sister. There's no blood relation, but is for all intents and purposes, she's like a sister to me. And believe me, for as much as she dishes at me, she may as well be my sister.
All right.
I will actually read what she wrote on the air because I think that it's pertinent, and I wonder how many other people actually have these questions and just are afraid to ask them.
Okay.
I want to put that off later because I think that it's a sidetrack from where we're going, but I want to point out that here's a person who is liberal, and she's starting to question and reach out, so. I think it solidifies what we've been saying about this election wasn't about a Republican mandate. It was about a repudiation of the policies and the governance of the other party.
Right.
Really, that's what it boils down to. And how do we, as conservatives, repudiate that even further and offer the electorate programs, ideas, everything that they need to make their lives better?
Well, what I would just, and this won't be a long thing, this is super ultra quick, it's real simple. First, connect on the reason that they do have a wall up, and I believe that's 220 years. It's been all white men until Barack Obama. They should have been upset about that. I don't blame them. Okay. But then I would say, you know what, Regent? We've now had 228 years of choosing a president over what divides us, the color of our skin. How about we choose a president over what unites us? Because you and I feel the same way about character. We feel the same way about competence. We feel the same way about hard work. We feel the same way about family. Why don't we choose leaders, forget what they look like, and choose leaders together and learn from the last 228 years and choose leaders together who are like us, who are like me and you?
I think that you're right. I think it comes back to a speech made in the 60s, content of character versus color of skin. And we're ready to take that step. I think at some point you say, well, we're going to judge people based on the content of their character. And quite frankly, some of these Republicans, we voted them out of office because of the content of their character. Mm-hmm. I gave you a certain representative, I think it was from Virginia. Yeah, he got primaried. Ooh, sorry, Cantor.
I think
actually,
that a
I'm
lot
not
of this...
sorry. I'm not sorry at all.
And getting back down to the messaging aspect of it, we have to have better messengers. And thankfully, when, you know, the reason why I was why I brought up jobs and a jobs program to begin with is because one of the main people behind it is Rand Paul, and Rand Paul has had a pretty good track record of being able to go to broad and diverse communities and not get completely shut down. So we are building slowly better messengers, and clearly we have done some work this election cycle when it comes to doing that, when it comes to being better about messaging to broad groups of people. So I think that there are certain things, particularly jobs, and certain messengers, particularly Rand Paul in this case, that can make these issues stick and not appear to be something that the president can just, you know, dismiss and the left can just dismiss as stupid ideas. And there are a lot of parts of the of these plans that have been accepted and praised by groups that are in these inner cities. So, sorry, Fish, you were going to say something? I can't hear you. Nope. Still can't hear you.
Felicia's taking on the role of the mime today, apparently.
No, it's not working.
No, there you are.
Hear you now.
Okay, good. I'm not going to move. sorry. That does bring up, when you said Rand Paul jogged my memory, it does bring up one of the things that we've talked about before on the refinery, but it bears repeating that as we are coming up on, I mean, now, the 2016 primary season, it's starting. I want to caution everybody again, too, not to make this about the last man standing, king of the hill sort of thing, but that we do need to look at everyone that's in the talent pool as resources for messengers in different communities or different areas of the electorate or whatever, and that we start looking at them not as, you know, the obstacle to get over, to get our guy at the top of the heap, but that we don't do that hero go round again. We don't do the tearing down of everyone else to the exclusion of, I mean, to where there's no one left standing that's got any credibility with a huge portion of the base. We have to be more mature this cycle. We have to look at people as assets, even if they're only agreeing with us 60% of the time or something, they're still an asset to us. Yes, you want to do everything you can to advance the guy that agrees with you the most, but in doing so, let's not leave scorched earth behind so that that guy can't go and reach his following for our guy if our guy's winning. We don't want to cut off our nose to spite our face there. I think it bears repeating over and over and over the next 2 years.
Yeah, we have to get away from the good guy, bad guy, because they're all on our side. They're all good guys. One is better than the other for a particular thing, and we will end up finding one who is better overall enough to be the POTUS candidate, but we've got to stop vilifying our own team.
What happens if, say, just off the top, just everybody hold your nose, but what happens if Christie becomes the nominee? Don't you want Rand Paul to be reaching his constituency, his following, and selling Christie to them in order for us to have a corporate win? Or vice versa. If Rand Paul is the candidate and he's the guy that's going to carry us across the finish line, don't you want Christie out on the campaign trail reaching the people who think like he does for Rand? No matter which way you look at it, you know, whether whoever your candidate is, you want the other guys supplementing your work, not tearing it down.
But we just saw a great example of all this in this election. In other words, I'm agreeing with you. And but look, you had Rand Paul, Chris Christie, Ted Cruz. You had establishment and Tea Party leaders going into the very same states, campaigning for the very same candidates, teaming up. That group went into Kansas and turned it around.
Well, that isn't the question that they will do it or not do it. I don't think any of the candidates in play in the end wouldn't do that thing. It's our expectations and rejecting them for doing it.
Yeah, no, what I mean is this. I'm saying use that as an example for all of us. Look, right. Our leaders can come together and suck it up because, why? Why? Because they're compromising? No. Because they believe in you. Because they want you to succeed. Because they love you, the conservative nation. And they will not let their divisions come in front of your success. Do the same.
I just want to point out that Rob in the chat has pointed out that the Fishy has yet again been a booster of Chris Christie, saying that of course Chris Christie is her candidate. That is exactly what she said. So yes, she is a fan of Chris Christie. And
I heard it. I was here. I heard the whole thing.
Well, hey, earlier today I wrote something saying that Chris Christie absolutely deserves a good amount of credit for today. He is the head of the Republican Governors Association, and he rightfully deserves credit for the massive success that the governor's elections had. And we know full well he will take advantage of that and he will use it, but God love him, Chris Christie did make it happen for governors, and he made it happen for Republicans all across the country. So
I think you just out-rhino-corned me.
Probably.
Just in the money he raised alone was spectacular. But no, Christie's not going to be the candidate in 2016. But
he can do some great things for the party in the meantime.
Oh, he's doing some fantastic.
And he proved that he just did, you know?
Look, how can we, on the one hand, get all excited? And I know Tea Party members who are thrilled and excited. I heard them on the radio today. Excited about the governorships we took in the Northeast.
Right.
How can you be excited about those and not take into account that those were taken by totally establishment-style Republicans? Because that's all they could win there. Come on, folks, it takes all kinds. I'm a Tea Party guy. I'd get creamed in the Northeast. They'd be carrying me out in parts. Okay? So that's just the way it would be. It takes all kinds. I love it. I don't want a party where everybody agrees with me. I would hate that. I want a party where people disagree with me and challenge me. If I didn't want that, I'd still be a Democrat.
I've got a question that comes from genuine ignorance, not disingenuousness. Do the Democrats call themselves by the divisions that we do, grassroots, establishment, Tea Party? We are constantly dividing ourselves. Do the Democrats do that?
No.
Okay, we have to stop that.
Well, yeah.
My gut is telling me that I should never ever refer to myself as a Tea Party or grassroots anti-establishment, that I should not be doing that anymore.
Well,
they do eat their own, so I think that they do divide themselves up because you have the Greens and you have the environmentalists, you have those who are for the women's lib movement, or I don't even know what they're feminists, I guess, are calling themselves. I can't keep track of their naming anymore. So they do divide themselves up. It's just that they're very united in that they have a common goal. It's just that they because their common enemy is us. If they didn't have a common enemy, God, they'd fall on themselves in a heartbeat.
Yeah, but you're totally right, but let's keep in mind, the divisions we have on the right, if we are opposed to each other, I mean, the differences we have on the right, if we are opposed to one another, those are divisions. If we unite, those are diversity, and they increase our outreach into all these various sectors of the population. And so in that way, it's not bad to be Tea Party, establishment, or so forth. It's okay if we don't do it as, sorry for the football analogy, it's not bad to be a wide receiver, quarterback, offensive lineman. You can still all work together. You're just doing something different. It's not so bad. But if we are going to be attacking each other like we've been, then that is what's setting us up. That is what has made us not succeed. And by the way, to a large degree, we set that aside in this election.
Yeah, that's what it was really impressive. But what I have seen, you know, almost immediately starting up was, again, Tea Party versus establishment and that kind of stuff. And that is, it's talked about in the media because the media likes to promote a fight, but we fall into it ourselves and consider, and we tend to describe ourselves as Tea Party versus the establishment Republicans rather than I'm a Tea Party Republican and along with the establishment Republicans we're going to do whatever. We tend to think of ourselves as not wide receiver versus running back. We think of ourselves as the Tea Party is, you know, the Redskins and the establishment is the Cowboys. And how's that for me throwing down some sportsing analogies?
Sportsing!
And that was like, those were both football teams, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Well, we don't know how long the Redskins will be a sports team.
I had to go politically incorrect, didn't I?
that was apparently something that played some impact in the Virginia race too. So that was an interesting side note that we don't need to talk about. But
I had a couple of notes that speak directly to what Leslie was talking about. There's a quote here. There's only one Democrat that matters now, who counts now, and that's the president. Anybody want to guess who said that? Anyone?
Mitch McConnell.
Did he really?
He
that
did.
That was a complete guess. But you know what? Everybody, all these haters, I need to get this off of my chest. All of these haters for Mitch McConnell, every single one of them, you guys do not know the can of whoop-ass that is going to be opened up this year. I am absolutely sure of it. Mitch had one thing that was in between him and getting stuff done, and that was Harry Reid. I mean, we couldn't do anything. We were at a standstill. So instead of doing a lot of stuff that gets us in trouble, that makes people upset with us, I'm not going to mention any names or anything that happened maybe last year sometime in the fall that made people really pissed off at us. But we have a chance to get some running room here, and I don't think that Mitch McConnell is going to be this, milquetoast, limp politician like Boehner's. And I fully admit that Boehner is horrible. But
Boehner out of a burning building.
But I will say that I think that Mitch McConnell has a lot more fight than he's giving credit for.
Here's another quote. This is great. The president has been protected from having to do things by not having legislation sent to him that he doesn't like. The Democrats have been running interference, and Mitch McConnell called them on it immediately and said repeatedly in his press conference, now we can get to work. The only thing that has been obstructing progress in this country is Harry Reid and the Democrat Senate. The Senate's changed. It's a new day in the Senate. Now we have the opportunity to get things done. The House has passed, and he listed hundreds, of bills that have been sent our way. We haven't been able to take up a thing because members want to vote. They want to get through and look at legislation and actually have a chance to vote on it, but it's not been happening under Harry Reid. Now things are going to change. And this was said in a very calm voice, in a very, bemused sort of, yes, here it's a good day, but not an aggressive fashion that, say, perhaps a Ted Cruz would have spoken in. Ted Cruz is a good attack dog for some things. When you're looking at the leader and the speaker or the majority leader, now you're talking about someone who you want to give off the impression of, oh, we're doing things. I don't understand why the president's complaining because here we have all these things that we're accomplishing and he's not coming to the table. He's not willing to negotiate with us. You want that kind of approach out of your majority leader, and then you want your junkyard dog on the side to be agitating and everything as well. It's part of a team. And so while McConnell is not my favorite senator by a long shot, I think he played things very well today. And I think given the contrast between Harry Reid, we are in for a lot of good legislation and the potential for some great messaging around that, even if nothing is ever going to be signed. And we need to come into that with that realistic expectation that everything the Senate passes will be vetoed by Obama, but everything that the Senate passes that he vetoes will be a forced statement from Obama on the fact that he doesn't want to work with the Senate.
Well, I would also like to suggest, too, that one of the consequences of the primary of Cantor and the near primary of Thad Cochran, and truly it was nearly, he was nearly primaried, is Mitch McConnell also had a really tough fight in Kentucky. When you have that, there are times when the establishment has to stop and reconsider and say, perhaps maybe I need to reconsider the way I've been approaching things. And I'm beginning to wonder, based on these statements from Mitch McConnell, if he hasn't actually said, you know what, maybe it's time that I changed my approach and started listening to my constituents a little bit more. Perhaps this whole establishment fight that we've been having is actually having the added benefit, I know it sounds sacrilege, of the establishment actually listening to the, quote, Tea Party. That doesn't mean that they follow everything that they want, but they do listen to the constituents a whole lot more than they have in the past. In other words, because of the way the Tea Party has adjusted the electorate, now the establishment has to actually deeply consider their actions and will adjust accordingly.
Wait a second. Are you suggesting that competition actually gets a better product?
Yes, I am.
That's a very paradoxical statement right there.
Well, as I saw the you know, the coalitions in the Republican Party kind of come together and win last night, it occurs to me that the message that really has been sent to everyone, particularly the establishment guys, is that the Tea Party has supported you. And what is human nature? I am going to work with and for and on behalf of those who support me. I'm going to like them, and I'm going to, they helped me achieve success. I'm going to help them achieve success. Somebody who is always yelling at me, hollering at me, complaining about me, and fighting against me, I'm not motivated to help. So some of these establishment types see that the Tea Party helped them to succeed. We, the Tea Party types, are now in a position to say, look, we helped you succeed. We will work with you. Now you have to work. You owe us and work with us. And they're more inclined to do so because we're working with them and they'll work with us. It's more of a positive, virtuous cycle than the cycle of enmity that we had before.
If I could draw another football analogy, being from Houston, I'm sorry, you know, sports team here, but we talk about a certain senator from Texas, and yes, I support him, but I see him more of sort of the role that we had with J.J. Watt on the Texans. Outstanding player, the most highest paid defensive player in the NFL. The man is outstanding. He's actually scored several touchdowns, both defensive, and they put him in as a wide receiver, and he scored a touchdown that way, caught a pass for a touchdown on the offense. But primarily, his role is to harass and harangue the quarterback on the opposite team. That is a vital role. But it doesn't necessarily score touchdowns. In fact, most often it does not. So you have someone like our great senator from the great state of Texas, Ted Cruz, who is feisty, who is a hard hitter, and his role is very vital in terms of what he has to do. And so he's done that because it's been necessary. But in turn, now it's time to go on the offensive, and that's where somebody like Mitch McConnell, as the leadership, is going to pick up the ball as the quarterback and take it forward. And you still need a solid defense, and I think that's where Ted Cruz still fills a role. And it also keeps Mitch McConnell in line because he's reminded constantly that, you know what, the people that gave you power, Mitch McConnell, is the same people that voted this guy in, so it's best that you listen to them, because if you placate them and you give them what they're after, your attack dog isn't necessarily as voracious as he once was because he doesn't have need to be. And if you turn him against your enemies, he's working for you rather than against you. And I think that when you have that sort of, using the analogy, when you have that sort of defense, it allows for your offense to actually start to do things and push the ball down the field the way that you want it to. So while we've railed against a certain senator, I think that he's served his role and he's served it rather well, and despite the fact that we feel like there's been some setbacks, because he's needed to do that. They said last year, oh, you know what, it's all going for the Democrats in 2014 because of what he did. Yeah, how did that work out?
You know, Laura Ingraham, great points, by the way, Peter. Laura Ingraham, I thought, put it really well. She said, you know, some people are talking like this is because these were all establishment candidates, pretty much. And it worked. The establishment candidates won in all these purple districts and states where the Tea Party candidates did not. But, she said, they all used Tea Party talking points. So you have all these establishment – good night, Ryan. You have all these establishment candidates talking like Tea Partiers, plus you've got establishment and Tea Partiers campaigning for each other in all these – across these states. And I think Mitch McConnell is an ideal leader for that kind of a coalition right now, because here's why. He's the kind of guy who doesn't mind letting – a Ted Cruz be Ted Cruz and go out. Ted Cruz is going to go out and kick ass. And McConnell's okay with that. All right. Even though, yeah, he said that one time, you know, we're going to beat the Tea Party. Well, you got to keep in mind, McConnell said that because he was getting beat up by Tea Partiers constantly. And he's a human being. Okay. But there are not just Tea Partiers in the Republican coalition. There's also some Northeast Republicans. And guess what? They have ideas too. And they would like to propose some ideas, too. And you need somebody who lets them propose their ideas, as well as Ted Cruz, as well as Rand Paul. It's a pretty diverse community, and I think Mitch McConnell could be a pretty good head for it.
Yes, I mean, certainly. And Rob brought this up in the chat, talking about wacko birds. There are certain other senators that are less friendly than Mitch McConnell. So I think that Mitch is just fine for this job.
Sorry, but the great thing about the wacko bird spouting senators is that now with this many Republicans, guess what? Guess who don't matter so much no more?
Yep. That's another great thing about winning this many seats, getting this much control of the Senate, is that now we don't need to rely on John McCain to, you know, do stuff. So we don't have to kowtow to him and Lindsey Graham, and, you know, name the other guys. Thad Cochran, we'll say, even Thad Cochran. And this is something that we preached for the entire election season, is that you got to remember that when Election Day comes around, the more Republicans that we elect, the better quality we're going to have from the Senate, because the ones that are not so conservative don't matter as much, and the ones who are conservative get to join the already pretty huge faction that's there in the Senate. So we're set. We're good. We're good with where we are right now. We just need to continue to push the momentum and remember that we have – it's not – you know, we're not done. We're not done by a long shot. We still have a lot of stuff that we have to fix. There's – you know, it's going to take us a long time to climb out of this hole that we've been in for the past, you know, ridiculous 9 years.
Well, I'd like to also – One more sports analogy. I got to ask: do you have to have superstars across the board to win? No. Well, okay, but let me ask this, because my real question is: could you win with the team that you have right now? I feel like the team that we have, with the way it's made up, we got a winning team here.
As long as our cornerbacks stay healthy for the rest of the season.
Yeah, there's that.
Milton Friedman made a perfect quote about this. The way you solve things is by making it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right thing. And I think that's where the strength in the diversity in the Republican Party is, and with the Tea Party, is that they have to listen, and they're listening more to the constituents than ever. Whereas I always see the Democrat Party as not being a party, or the Democrats I know, they elect their leaders and then treat them as leaders and sit back and follow. And that's a perfect example of why they're in the position they are today. It's been follow the leader. The leader's been Barack Obama, and it hasn't paid off for them. So now they need to pay attention to that.
Delbert is so right. Think about this. Just take a moment and take this in. Okay, when Tea Party ignited, you saw Republicans jumping to join that, and now you see them campaigning using Tea Party language, right? But from the Democrat side, what you get is a few people in the academia or in, you know, these, I guess, rarefied air environments who have these theories about how the world should work, and then they push that down to people and have them carry that message. We did it backwards from that. We brought the issues to the table, and the Republicans picked them up. That's a true grassroots influence, and it does mean that, in essence, we have, regardless of who's in office, been driving the agenda, regardless of whether we have establishment candidates elected or Tea Party candidates elected or people that are libertarian-leaning or more traditional conservative-leaning. We've been driving the agenda. We've not had it issued to us. We've not been given talking points. We made the talking points. We dragged this conversation into the country, into the leadership, into all the way up the halls of power. And we did it without the kind of real red in tooth and claw, Republican, conservative, red meat type of people at the top. And that just goes to show that we're the motive power. And that means that with all the suggestions Andy's made in his piece, you know, what should we do when we if we win, we are still the motive power. That thought hadn't occurred to me until Delbert said that. But how exciting is that? I feel all of a sudden, in the last 5 minutes, really quite liberated going forward, because honestly, seeing where I was 5 years ago at the beginning, setting up the rallies that we did, and where we are now in a national conversation, that sort of thing doesn't happen. But we did it. So here we are at the beginning of this 2 years before 2016 with all the things that we're anticipating happening. But guess who's still driving the agenda? We are. We have the power to make these types of thoughts and these conversations happen. And then drag, of course, all the elected officials along with us. How exciting is that?
I agree with her, absolutely. I agree with you, Fishy, that that's absolutely exciting. It's imperative that we understand that, too. Because remember at the end of 2008, the election happened, Barack Obama was swept into power, the Democrats were swept into power, they took the Senate, they had the Senate and the House, they could vote on anything they wanted, whatever they wanted they could push through. And I remember to this day, Carville sitting on TV and talking, he made a prediction 40 years of Democratic control of Congress. It would be 40 years before the Republicans ever came back. And there's only one group of people that turned that around, and that was the grassroots, the Tea Party of the United States. And that's exactly what they did. So when you look at the Republican leadership, it's like, hi, we're here. Guess who brought you back? This guy, that gal, all the people that you see on this show. That's who brought you back. It wasn't, oh, well, we've got our consultants and the establishment. If we just follow our little plan here, we can find our way back. No, you were relegated to the backwaters of politics. And we came back and said, oh, it appears that you don't know what you're doing. So this is the message that you should be driving. These are the candidates you should be putting up. Oh, well, you know what? You don't want to listen to us? Primaried. And suddenly they're like, I guess we better listen to these people. They turned it around. So... absolutely correct.
I think that this is a really important time for us as a movement, and you're right, we do have the microphone now, we do have the baton, and we can drive this thing. The thing is that we need to make sure that, you know, again, what the entire point of the refinery is getting these messages to a point where they are not beatable by the Democrats, where they are something that people, everyday people who are not interested in politics, you know, hear them and they make sense, and they're something that they want to get behind, and they, you know, they understand that, hey, I need a job. This is ridiculous. I've been out of work for, you know, however long, and unemployment is done with. I need to get a job, and the climate is not, and nobody's hiring, so we need to get something done there. Or my healthcare is gone out the window. I'm not happy with that. There are things that we can do to get this back on track and to actually, and I said back on track, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to say back on track. I mean to say moving forward. I mean to say achieve new highs. That's what I'm looking for. But that's where we need to go next.
Well, and that's exactly right, Jersey. And I'm glad that you brought up employment, because what's the best way to approach somebody who's been on unemployment and turn them? You look at them and say, do you really want to be on unemployment for 2, 3, 4 years? Or would you rather have a job? Why is it that people push for longer unemployment roles when the reality is that that what you're depriving them of is the joy, and it truly is the joy of actually getting a job where you're off unemployment, you have a job, and now suddenly the future seems brighter. I mean, I got off unemployment and I got a job, and I tell you what, man, I just felt like I was king of the world, and it wasn't something that lasted a day or two. It lasted months. I was just so happy to have work. I was putting in 50, 60 hours. I didn't care. I had a job. I had opportunity. And when we say, well, we need to give people more unemployment, why? So we can beat them down further? I mean, talk about a wonderful opportunity to approach people in this nation and turn them conservative and say, hey, do you want to be on employment unemployment and government dull for longer, or do you want to be unleashed and actually be able to follow and achieve your dreams? Is your dream what Nancy Pelosi said, where you have all this free time because you're only working 20 hours a week? Or is your dream that you can actually pursue the things that you want because you're making the money that you need to do that?
But they're terrified. When you lose your job and you're at home and the weeks start going by and no one's calling, or you keep going to interviews, but there's 50 people for every job, and you start to become terrified of the failure, you start to become terrified of telling your wife or husband or kids it didn't happen again. Couldn't we, you know, because I wrote that thing Back in Business, couldn't we do a program like that? Can't we as Republicans start telling people, look, let's get them... You know, ideally, I'm a libertarian at heart. I want no government involvement in the private sector and in jobs, period. Obviously, okay? But.
Thank you.
No, obviously that's what I want. But here's the problem, Peter. We have a society that has been absolutely trained in socialism. And what I want to do is use the systems that are in place, change them, obviously, to get people hooked on capitalism. And so what I'd like to see us do is, you know, you're going to get that welfare unemployment check or whatever. You are going to be placed not in a government job, but in the private sector through placement agencies. Everybody is put back in business. Everybody is put back out there. And the reason is this, to keep you in the game, because as you are at home, you develop fear. You develop fear of all that you develop fear that you will never have all that wonderful stuff that Peter just said he has, that he just experienced a wonderful freedom, because I want these people to have that too. But we got to break them through the fear. They need to get back out into the real world where they are needed, where people actually need them to show up on Monday. And it's important to people that you're there, because you know what the worst thing is? When you lose a job and you hear from people that, you know, you thought you were so needed, and you hear from people who are still there, everything just went on without you. And it's devastating. It's devastating. And so, and then what we do is the Democrats put in a system that keep you with an eternal safety net under you in that fear. And you grow to be terrified of the failure. What we need to do is get people back out there. I'd like to you'll get the safety net's still there. We can't just transition them from one to the other instantly. It's ridiculous. It's like having the Middle East suddenly become democratic. But instead, first have them spend that 20 hours a week or whatever in the workplace, leaving them enough time to job hunt too, and have that business pay in, say, 30% of their fees, of their welfare or unemployment. The taxpayers save millions of dollars. These people are back in business. They're getting a taste of capitalism, and the fear gets to go away. We get to show them how great it is to recapture that. It's a win-win. It's good for business. They get cheaper labor. It's good for the taxpayer. They save millions. It's good for the people. They get back out there. What do you think?
I think that that would be an outstanding idea. I think that it's a good stepping stone, and I agree with you. You can't just shove them out the door. You have to do a transition. You can't. I mean, I realize that there's a lot of kids that learned how to swim just because dad threw them in the pool, and to be fair, that works for some people, but for others, that's not the case. And quite honestly, for a lot of people, the fear of water is such that they can't just jump in the pool and learn how to swim. They need to have that support system there, and so when you have that transition period, it allows them to transition out and say, you know what, suddenly I have hope again. Suddenly I have this feeling that there's opportunity out there. And, man, it's a good feeling. And you want to give that to people. And so I look back at 2008 and the Democratic Party and the platform that they ran on. They didn't deliver much of anything that they actually promised. What they were promising is what people really wanted in the first place, which is what we've been talking about all along, which was, and I know that there's the hope and change thing. They delivered the change, which is just spare change in your pocket if you're lucky. But what they really delivered was change in terms of changing the system. The hope that people were wanting was, hey, well, we're going to get rid of partisan politics. Hey, what we're going to get rid of is we're going to get rid of these crony capitalists. Well, you know what? Democrats aren't going to get rid of them because they need them, desperately need them. What we're going to get rid of is we're going to get rid of this hidden government. Well, we didn't get less of it. We got more of it. So everything that they were saying that they wanted, which is what people were saying, well, no, this guy promised that he would transcend that. Well, he didn't transcend it. He just delivered it in you know, a harsher form. He says, not only am I going to give it to you, I'm going to give it to you good and hard. And that's why you have both the election of 2010 and the election of 2014 is a huge repudiation of Barack Obama and the Democratic policies, because they didn't deliver on the things that they were promising, which is what people really wanted in the first place: a better economy, more opportunity, the ability to actually chase the dreams that you have. And guess what? You know what? We can build in some safety nets if we have to, but we're gonna set it up so that you can actually have a safety net. But really, it's just a transition period so that you can stay on your feet and continue to chase your dreams. I mean, how awesome is that? I mean, I'm not one for big government because I'm totally opposed to it. But at the same time, you know, I'm not opposed to the fact that maybe we need to have a transition period where we transition out of big government into smaller government and into minimalist government. You can't just do it overnight. And because if you do that, there's going to be chaos. And so you have that transition period. Go ahead. And
isn't it kind of a delicious concept to use the power of big government as it's structured now to dismantle itself? What other mechanism can we use that can so thoroughly do that if we can restructure programs in order to eventually make them obsolete?
Turn big government into an Ouroboros? That sounds really cool. I like the idea. Can this welfare to work thing be a state level type program, or would it have to be federal? I'm thinking that state level would be best.
I would have it be state. I'd have it be block granted. And Leslie, I'd go one step further in combining it with Rand Paul's idea in the inner cities, because what I would have it be just 5 to 10% of your workforce. Okay, and that's all you can have it be of your workforce, so that we don't impact, you know,
other employees, right?
Regular wages too much. But by the way, there was another thing I didn't mention in this. A lot of people who are at the workplace have lost jobs too, or maybe they went through back in business. So now you're a back in business person who's at the workplace. You're going to get a lot of support. You're going to have people, rather than being at home alone with the fear and terror and worthlessness growing and saying, oh my gosh, I lost a job and all I hear about is how they don't need me anymore. You're going to have people right there that you see who relate to you. But one thing that I would add is kind of Rand Paul's idea. What about it in the inner cities? You go 20%. We're really going to help businesses get going in the inner cities and have them have a greater percentage of back in business people to get started. Right now, all we're doing is paying millions of people to do nothing.
Well, exactly. But and you take that whole inner city thing and you actually start to use the Democrats' platform against them. And it's perfect because they've set up the system that you can now turn and say, well, this is what you had. This is what we propose, and we're going to use their methods slyly. But, I mean, talk about, you know, a complete turn on its head. You're taking the Democratic message of 2008 and turning it back on themselves. How do they fight that? Because they didn't deliver on their promises.
And it's actually adapting a program that already exists, which we currently participate in the restaurant biz. There's a form that all applicants have to fill out that where you're asked the question, is anybody on your household on welfare? Are you an ex-con? Are you on food stamps? And were you in the military? And based on your answers to those questions, your employer can get a tax credit at the end of the year. You know, for example, if we hire an ex-con from a food stamp family, we can get a $4,800 tax credit at the end of the year if the person is employed with us for X amount of time, whatever. But that's so we know that philosophically there is agreement in government that we should motivate employers to get people off of food stamps and to hire ex-cons to bring them into the working economy. So we know that philosophically they want us to do that. But the way the program is right now, the benefit to the employer doesn't come until after the employee has worked X amount of months with your company, and it's at the end of the year, and it's a tax credit. It's a very late, it's very decoupled from the actual hiring of the employee, and you don't see a direct and immediate benefit, whereas the back in business program is direct and immediate, and if the employee is only with you for a month, both the employee and the employer are benefiting for that month,
yeah,
which makes it even better.
Yeah, because it's simple, you know, supply side economics, you know, supply and demand. You want them to want to have them there. It's cheap help right now, and their first I even wrote it up. Their first 2 weeks, you don't have to pay a dime. So for their first 2 weeks of training, they're free. They're on the taxpayer.
Right. Okay. It's after immediate that, motivation for the employer and immediate. You know, an immediate work for the employee, and it's direct, it's immediate, it's fast to see, and it's implemented quickly and easily from what I can see of your plan. I like
that. Right. They start burning through people too quickly. Let's say that you are a bad employee. First of all, if you're on drugs, if you fail drug tests, you go into rehab until you're cleared, and then you go back in the system. But if you're a bad employee and you keep getting fired, you can only get fired so many times before you're out of the system. By the same token, if you're a business who can't keep somebody because you're a bunch of jerks and you keep firing everybody who comes through, you could be kicked off the system.
Right.
Yeah. You know what? I just had this realization. If we were to take this sort of legislation and actually attempt through the House and the Senate as newly constructed starting next year and attempted to pass these reforms with these kind of stories, can you imagine what liars the Democrats would have to prove themselves to be by trying to block it? Taste that. Just breathe it in and taste that forcing the Democrats at every turn, taking what they claim the ownership of, these ideas about caring for the poor and trying to get people back to work and caring about jobs and whatever, and making them put lie after lie label to every one of their platform planks because the Republicans are actually getting it done.
You must allow every person to experience what Peter was talking about. Everyone must have the chance to matter. Otherwise, your system means nothing. You're putting them on life support. They are nothing but something that tubes go into.
And from, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that because that's exactly right. As you hit people on an individual level, my contribution to the conservative movement is less, you know, hey, I'm knocking on doors, and I'm not saying that that's bad. I totally agree with that. I think that's awesome. It's just that my contribution, I feel, is engaging people on a personal level, on a personal basis, and saying, you know, here's where things are at. This is the way I see things. And since I tend to be more libertarian than conservative, and that doesn't mean that, you know, hey, I like to smoke pot and there are no rules type thing. Not like that, but, you know, less government. And pointing out and say, okay, here's the line where here's the point where you're wanting. And the Democrats are promising that to you, but they haven't delivered any of that. Yes, Obamacare sounds great. And look, your rates are skyrocketing. It was supposed to lower them, not raise them. And you can't sit there and blame Republicans when it was Democrats that passed it. Holy. And so you have that, I want to engage you on a personal level. I want to talk about your personal life. I want to talk about the things that are affecting you personally. And suddenly, you take the Democrats out of it, you just use it and say, is that where you want to go? Or is this where you want to go and lay out what we're talking about? Because I think when people hear that the ideas that we've been discussing here, where you have this idea where you can get back into the workforce, you're giving credits to businesses to hire people part-time so that people are starting to transition out of being unemployed to being employed, and you're engaging more people in the workforce, people are going to stand up and go, I'd like to be part of that. And I don't think it's a few hands. I think it's millions of hands.
I was typing it, but I'll just say it. Peter, I've described Back in Business to dozens of people from all political persuasions, including Democrats. I've yet to hear somebody who doesn't love the idea. I don't know why it would be that hard to get it through. I honestly don't. I mean, but I'm a nobody, so I don't know. I mean, I'm not the governor of whatever.
Andy, I actually want to give you a chance there. In the chat, Rob has said basically that you can't guarantee the businesses will succeed, though, in the inner city. So if it starts to fail, does the government step in? And then he makes a reference to the Kobayashi Maru test, I believe, is what he's doing there. But
Star Trek?
I'm sorry?
Star Trek?
Star Trek, yes. I think that's what he's saying there. But
I don't believe in no-win situations.
Right.
To be fair, I do work with computers, so I totally would reprogram it.
Exactly. So that, I guess that is the question is, what is to prevent this from just being flat-out corporate welfare or, you know, business welfare? How is that handled?
Right. I mean, well, let's face facts. To a degree, any unleashing of investment in the inner city is corporate welfare to get it back on its feet. There is no way that it isn't, and I got to be honest, I'm uncomfortable with that. I don't like corporate welfare to give that kind of an advantage, including enterprise zones, because you're not giving that, you know, you're not giving that low tax advantage to businesses that are outside of the inner cities. So even Jack Kemp's idea, which was, you know, put forth by Rand Paul, is a form of corporate welfare. All right. So yes, I would agree that is a problem, and perhaps because of that, we shouldn't change it for the inner cities. My only thing is this: the inner city is so gone that we need to show, look, we have millions of voters there who are voting for socialists to destroy us because they don't believe we want to bring capitalism to them. And we can look at them and say, bring it to yourself. No, no, come on, let's be real. They have no money. They have no hope. All they have is a government check, all right? We need to change that. But how can we change that if the businesses in the area, if there are no businesses in the area to participate in the program? See, all I'm saying is, to raise the percentage of the number of employees that they could have on staff to be part of the program. It's the same amount of money per employee. Nothing has changed. And the reason is because, you know, ordinarily that's considered a bad thing by big labor. You see, big labor is the biggest reason you wouldn't want it to go above 5 or 10% because it goes much higher and it depresses wages. I'm just saying in the inner city there are no wages. And so you wouldn't have to worry so much about offending the unions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it would be a pretty interesting situation where you have the unions working against jobs. I mean, and it would be unions working against jobs with the pipeline, unions working against jobs with this. It puts unions in a very interesting place on a public relations standpoint when people start realizing that unions are basically cartels at this point.
Put the lie to everything. Make them admit the lie of everything they say they believe in.
It's a lot easier to put the lie to everything they say if we bring an alternative. I know you're saying that, Fishy. I just wanted to restate it from my side. Right now, guys, we can't counter any of the lies that are buying these millions of votes because we're not bringing anything. Right? That's crazy. Yeah. Why would we, the people who are in love with capitalism, who get a job and are so excited about that, not want to bring it to them or find a way to do it?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's so exciting about this. And I think it is time to take, you know, tomorrow's Thursday, Throwback Thursday. Everybody go share Back in Business as an article. It's in our chat. It's in our internal chat here. Because it is something that would be good to get people talking about. You know, just I'm giddy just thinking about it.
I'm going to need to bow out soon, but I wanted to bring up one thing that just came to my mind, is that in 10 days we find out, people are going to find out what their Obamacare enrollment's going to cost them that was delayed until after this election. So, and with that, I'm going to say goodnight to everybody.
Goodnight, Delbert.
Night.
Goodnight, Delbert. Yeah, we should probably be wrapping up, even though, you know, we're still pretty much hyped from yesterday's events.
Yes. And
from where we're going forward.
Sorry. Another hour's worth of discussion to go on. And we're like, no, wait. Hold on. We got to keep going.
I wanted to bring something up that I had thought about earlier today when I was looking at the election results, and everybody had a prediction. I looked at a ton of articles. Everybody was saying, this is what that means. This is what this means. All the predictions happened. I read all those last week. All of the results and the analysis happened this week. And I think that one thing I wanted to bring to the table is the idea that the American people are really, really bad at telling what they want. They're very disjointed about what they're actually for, what they want. But yesterday showed that the American people are very good about telling what they do not want. And that people, that sort of goes back to the, is it a mandate, is it not a mandate, is it a support of Republicans, or is it actually a repudiation of the president? I think we have our answer. The American people are very good at saying what they do not want.
Well, aren't we just sort of like the classic woman? The guy says, hey, honey, where do you want to go for dinner? Oh, anywhere's fine, I don't care. And he brings up 12 different suggestions, and we say no, 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 not that one, not that one, not that one. We don't know where we want to go, but we sure as hell know where we don't want to go.
And single-handedly,
it's just common.
Single-handedly, Leslie has just reignited the war on women.
Although I think I called all of American voters women, typical women, emotional, crazy women. And as a crazy woman, do I not have the absolute moral authority to make that claim? Or since I'm a Republican, I'm not actually a real woman or something? I get confused.
You're a wino.
I'm a wino? I don't even like wine. Oh, wait, was that not what you're talking about? Hold on.
Woman in name only.
Woman in name only? Oh, God, great. And with that, we should probably call it a day for today, huh? Oh, great. Okay.
Yes. There are going to be clips. There are going to be clips sometime in the future, probably like in a few hours in the future. So we'll have that up on Conservative Union. And
YouTube channel?
On the YouTube channel over there and all of that fun stuff. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of clips that kind of got, nobody really got to see them because of all the excitement from this election. So those are good to check out as well. Go through and take a look at some of the clips that you might have missed. And of course, we have Brass here, who is, of course, the host of Foreign Matters. And Foreign Matters, unless there's something that I was not aware of, Foreign Matters will be on tomorrow night at 9 p.m. as usual.
Actually, it won't be. We're going to cancel the show for tomorrow. I have a previous engagement, so the show. I'm sorry. I was going to post that tomorrow first thing, so next week.
You still gave good promo there, honey.
Thank you. Yes. Appreciate that. Appreciate the promo for the show that won't be airing. Yes.
Right. So not this Thursday, not tomorrow, but next Thursday, will be all sorts of good stuff with Stefan and George and the whole crew from Format. So there you go.
Very cool. And we will be back next week on Tuesday rather than Wednesday, because there's not an election again for another year at least. And if we can hold off on talking presidential candidates for another week or two, I would love it if we could hold off until like next year. I don't know if that's going to be possible, but the longer we can delay that conversation, the better. Because by the time that all rolls around, I'll just hate them all, and I won't know which one I want. I'll know which ones I don't want, because I'm a typical woman.
As a white male, I'm right now expressing my support for Lindsey Graham. And
the whitest.
Because he is the leader of the Bad Joke Party. So I am going to be a supporter of his. Going into
he's the whitest in the terms of Graham Cracker. The white cracker.
No.
I am so glad that the 2014 elections are over, because I've been looking forward to 2 years of presidential run-up.
Are you? You were dropped on your head as a child, right? That's just
That was tongue firmly in cheek.
I didn't see the sarcasm font. Sorry.
Right. See, otherwise he knows I'd have to drive over there and hit him with a bat. And so he would
repeatedly,
His wife would hold him down.
She would too. Totally would.
Love it, I love it. Okay, guys, we're gonna wrap this episode up for today. Thank you very much for watching, listening, and being with us this one day late post-election celebration episode. And what is that you've got, Felicia? What is that? Are you waving your baton? Is that the Sword of Destiny? What is that?
Is that the talking stick? We have to pass it to talk or something?
I think it's the bat that she's going to go and whack.
It's the
bat that has my name on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It on the side.
Got it. Okay, cool. And we're all now scared of little fishy. Okay, thank you guys.
Now.
Hey, she doesn't actually hit me in the head. It's the kneecaps. That's what's scary.
That's as high as she can reach. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, she can go just a little higher, unfortunately.
Oh, and then all the men in the refinery are sopranos. Yes, and we don't mean the crime family. Woohoo. Here, is this...
There's a button there, Leslie.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, anyway, we are done for the evening, probably more so. Thank you guys for listening, and we will see you guys next week.
Suck it, progressives.
Woo! Bye.